This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Earth, wind, fire, and water. The basic elements of the world, the basic elements of life. From KRFP Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and today our show is called Elements. We have four pieces, each of which focuses on one of these elements. We'll start with a simple question asked by a daughter to her father. It comes from Christy Schwartz.
Daddy, where does water come from? I must have been 7 years old when I asked him this question. He paused and looked up in the air, which meant his answer was going to take a long time to surface. My dad often takes long moments like this, which I found frustrating as a child. To avoid annoyment, I would focus my attention to other things, like owls hooting in the darkness and the cool air on my skin. We always seemed to talk more at night. After a moment, he sighed, looked at me and said, "The earth." I stared back at him as if he was a ghost. Was that really his answer? This was really much more basic than I was expecting. "But how?" I asked. Looking back, I suppose I was expecting something similar to Aldo Leopold's poetic rendition of atom recycling in his essay Odyssey. After all, my dad knew everything. "The earth makes it," he shrugged. I could have again asked, "How does it make it?" But I had been down this road with adults several times. I knew eventually the answer would be something like, "It just does," which in adult language translates as, "Give it up, kid. Forget it." This is something I was never very good at. I suppose I'm still not. I realize what frustrated me most about my dad's answer was the simplicity of it. When I left for college, my water question, and many more like it, still nagged at me. I majored in environmental science, where I was able to learn scientific explanations for natural phenomena. I learned about the water cycle and that the earth, skies, and seas reformat atoms into and out of water molecules on a daily basis. I learned that my dad's answer of the earth creating water was not quite accurate. It doesn't create water, because water has always existed, or at least the oxygen and hydrogen that make up water always have. I learned of theories and tools that attempted to explain the world, like the Big Bang, carbon dating, and evolution.
The clouds get heavy and the rain pours down. Precipitation and more puddles on the ground. Oh, the water cycle round and around. Vapor goes up and the rain comes down.
Science has done a beautiful job in explaining complex situations through modeling and theory. What I learned most during my four-year degree is that I ended with more questions than I started with. The answers I found in science left my soul with an empty feeling. The answers I found in religion left a bitter taste in my mouth and seemed desperately anthropocentric. My original water question hurled me down a spiritual, metaphysical quest that I have still yet to return from. Where does water come from? I recently realized I have been asking the wrong question for the last couple of decades. My question to my father was really not where does water come from, but why does it form? And in the same matter, why do we humans form? To be able to truly answer where water comes from, where this world comes from, we give a person an ability to answer life's deepest creation questions. What or who created this place? How did it get here? When did it happen? Perhaps it was a little unfair of me to expect my dad to have a thorough answer to the mystical nature of our world without advanced warning. Still, my 7-year-old brain is alive and always questioning, even today. Why do we exist? Why am I here? And a million other why questions that adults love to hear. So Dad, or anyone else that may have an answer, I would love to hear it. Even a simple answer would be a good place to start.
Water circles, water cycles, water dances, watch it spin. As the water coming to us goes around and round again.
And that starts off this Element show with a piece from Christy Schwartz. From water to wind. Wind and water do come together at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Last year, I talked with NOAA's Michelle Mainelli of the Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida, about hurricane names. Installment number two, Michelle Mainelli on hurricane names. I'm on the phone with Michelle Mainelli. She's a hurricane specialist at the National Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida. She's joining me by phone to talk about hurricane names. Thanks for joining me, Michelle.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with just the basics. How do hurricanes get their names?
Hurricanes, since 1978, the United Nations World Meteorological Organization, which is a group that represents about 120 different countries around the world, they determine a list of names for tropical storms for each ocean basin of the world. And for the Atlantic Basin, it falls under this Regional Association 4. And what they provide is a group of meteorologists get together every year and determine what the next 6 years' supply of names are going to be for every upcoming years of the hurricanes. And we use 21 names for each year, and a lot of people ask, why do you use 21 names, and there's 26 letters in the alphabet? Well, we don't use the letters Q, U, X, Y, and Z, because there just aren't enough names that would fill that many years, recurring years. And in the case of names for hurricanes and tropical storms out there, or typhoons even, I mean, everything's determined by a predetermined list, and you have a certain number of names, and if you retire a name, then you have to come up with a new name, and if you use the letters Q, U, X, Y, and Z, we wouldn't have enough of those names to keep filling in.
Why names instead of something more scientific or bland, or, you know, the first one of the year or something like that? Why do we go for names?
Names, usually, it as far as trying to get the message out and communicating that message to the communities, wherever they may be around the world, it just provides an ease of communication between forecasters and the general public. And long ago, I mean, it started, these names have evolved over the years. And long ago, it was just named, you know, storm number one or storm number two, and then it got confused of which year you were referring to these. And then during World War II, tropical cyclones were informally given women names by the Army, Air Corps, and the Navy meteorologists, and they named them after their girlfriends and wives, actually. And from 1950 to 1952, tropical cyclones across the Atlantic were identified by the phonetic alphabet, Abel, Baker, Charlie, etc. But then in 1953, the U.S. Weather Bureau, they switched to women's names. And they had women's names going on for a while, and then in 1979, finally, the World Meteorological Organization, combined with the U.S. National Weather Service, switched the list to include names that also included men's names as well.
I had not really remembered that, but now that you say that, I do know that. I grew up in Florida. I grew up with hurricanes all around me all the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's interesting that they changed the naming structure.
Equal opportunity.
Yeah, I've felt like a storm before, but I know guys can be stormy too.
That's exactly.
Well, I'm sure it's much easier to remember. So that's a nice thing about having the names. When it comes to choosing the names, you think they're using the girlfriends and boyfriends' names anymore?
I think some of the names, maybe when the meteorologists, part of the WMO, the World Meteorological Organization, get together, I mean, there may be names that get submitted, and the names get voted. So, for example, if a name is retired, such as Katrina was retired back in 2005, the group of meteorologists got together and they put together a list to and vote on what names they were going to replace that on. And sometimes names that get thrown in there might be some relatives and something, or some history of knowing somebody or somebody of meteorological or forecasting experience or something like that. But generally they try to pick a name that is easy to pronounce and familiar to people and doesn't cause a lot of difficulty for the media.
And I was wondering about that familiarity thing. If there's, you said 6 commissions throughout the world?
We supply a 6-year supply of names. And there's the World Meteorological Organization, and it represents so many different countries. But, for example, for the Atlantic Basin, it's Region 4, it's considered.
Oh, that's what I was meaning, the regions then.
Yeah, yeah.
So with the multiple regions, within a region, the names need to be familiar enough and common enough.
Correct. So, like, for the Atlantic Basin, it does reflect an international mix of, say, English, Spanish, and French cultures. But when you get maybe towards the Pacific and the Central Pacific, they may have more Hawaiian names. And further you go out, I mean, they'll do some regional type Asian names, maybe in the Northwest Pacific.
Do you think names get become bad names after a really bad storm?
They could be. There might be, you know, connotations from general, like, oh, well, you know, bad Hurricane Andrew or Hurricane Katrina, and it may have, you know, some, obviously those that experienced and had to live through those storms probably aren't going to, they're going to relate it hopefully to the storm and not the particular name of something that it was given, but it could be misrepresented in that way.
On the other hand, maybe the names get adopted because if you're not in the eye of the storm or in this, you know, well, actually, in where it really hits the worst, and you kind of just lose lights, and you know, you have a good storm, and you are able to be safe, you can just hang out there and enjoy a good storm. But your lights are out, and you're having nothing to do but barbecue the food in your freezers before it goes bad, and fool around a little bit. So there's probably lots of babies coming out. I wonder if they get named. Do we see more babies with the same name after that?
I've never done any. I've never heard of any statistics on that, but it would be very interesting to see if that kind of happened over the years with the storms. Maybe when the power would be out, maybe longer back in the 60s, 70s, 80s or something before we had all these underground cabling with electricity, if that occurred with how names would be with the upcoming kids.
That's a good point, because that's what I'm thinking of, is that we always assume that the kid the names, the number of babies increased 9 months later, and that the names were likely to be related if the storm wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
Well, I know there's a lot to talk about hurricane preparedness and safety, and I don't want to give that, you know, don't want to just toss that aside, but I do want to ask you something else before we talk about that, and that is just about the romance and allure of storms. I personally feel that. I'm kind of guessing you do if you're a hurricane specialist. How do you get into being a hurricane specialist, and how do you feel about storms?
Well, getting into meteorology and specifically studying hurricanes and tropical meteorology, I mean, it really is most of the forecasters you meet. I mean, it is something that there's been a desire and an ambition since most of us have been a very young age. So you're kind of either like born with it and the desire, and you really do end up having a passion. In my experience, the more experience I get in forecasting, the more respect I have for the weather, and the more there is to know. So the more you learn, the more you realize what you don't know, and how Mother Nature can just surprise you at any minute, and it's always something different of what's going on and new experiences, and you just try to study and research this phenomena to the best of your ability and try to improve with every forecast you make.
Tell me a little bit about hurricane preparedness then. What do people need to know? Even for those of us out in Idaho. Sometimes we visit the coast.
Okay. Well, it is important, especially for those vacationers out there that kind of migrate to the coast, somewhere along the East Coast, Gulf Coast of the United States, and even across the Caribbean. You take trips over the summer months to these places, and you may not be familiar with hurricane preparations and evacuations. And what's Important to know if you happen to live in these places, then you always have a hurricane preparedness. You have a plan. You have a plan in place ready before the season happens, and that includes of knowing if you're in an evacuation area under certain categories of hurricanes. It's also knowing if how far and knowing what kind of supplies you're going to need if you're not in an area of evacuation, and if you're in a sturdy building and that you can protect your windows, then in some cases it's best to stay where you are and kind of hunker down and protect yourself and stay in place instead of trying to get on that road and with all those folks trying to evacuate that really need to. Now, if you're a visitor and you're vacationing in these areas and a hurricane threatens the area, then it's really important to stay close to the local media and emergency managers across whatever country or place that you're at, and they're going to inform you or the hotels to exactly what to do. And it's very important in these situations to really abide by whatever information is given to you and recommended. If you're asked to leave an area, then you need to take that serious into consideration. You need to leave.
Great. Thank you. I have one more question for you, Michelle.
Absolutely.
Has there ever been a hurricane, Michelle?
There was. There was actually, I actually had the opportunity to fly into Hurricane Marilyn back in 1995. And that hurricane was retired because of the amount of significant damage and loss of life that occurred over portions of the islands, especially Puerto Rico. And the replacement name was Hurricane Michelle. And in 2000, Hurricane Michelle occurred in the Caribbean. It was a Category 5 hurricane. And it caused tremendous amounts of flooding and damage across Cuba and some other areas across the Caribbean. And actually, the name was retired. So I was a one-hit wonder.
Very good. I don't think that there's as, it's certainly not as likely that there's going to be a Hurricane Sandy. We're not going to get down that far too often.
Usually we do not get down to all the way down to the S's. There has been more active years in the mid-90s, and then we saw in 2005 that we went through the entire 21 name list. And if that occurs, then it goes into the Greek alphabet of alpha, beta, and so forth. And that's the contingency plan for a list of names.
Well, I know with climate change, we're always afraid we may need to go there, but so far, so good.
So far, so good.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Michelle.
Thank you so much, Sandy. It was great talking with you.
That was Michelle Mayanelli with me by phone from the National Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida. This is Yin Radio, and in this show, we're exploring the elements earth, wind, fire, and water. Installment number 3, fire. Jessica Hawkinson is a firefighter. She works on an engine. That's what they call the equipped pickup trucks that go out to the fire lines. And this is an engine that her dad runs. She works side by side with her older brother, and she's been at it now for 4 years. There are more and more women firefighters, but they're still relatively rare. And she's the only one on her crew. Here's how it works.
Well, it's not very glamorous. That would probably be the first thing. It's dirty, sweaty, nasty, hard work. It's the hardest work I've ever done in my life. Every day, it's like 12 to 16 hour days. And you have to wear all of your PPE all day long, every day. Your hard hat, your long sleeve, Nomex shirt and pants, socks and boots and gloves, and our fire shelters. And that's like a pack that we have to wear. And it's just, I mean, different things every day. Digging line, digging fire line, running hose lays, pumping water.
But it's not just hard physical work, it's hard mental work too.
Mainly just staying safe. That's your biggest concern is staying safe. And a lot of the mental thing is working well with everybody, you know, not because when bad things happen out there, it's power struggles. when people get hurt, when people die, it's usually a power struggle that causes it. That's somebody thinking that this is what you should be doing or this is what you should be doing, and just that collision gets things disorganized and people where they're not supposed to be, and bad things happen then. And a big thing of it is not getting cabin fever and getting, you know, you're out there with the same people for 14-day rolls at a time. And it's, you just gotta keep yourself sane. that's the big thing, probably.
Do you have any techniques for keeping sane?
Yeah, I sketch a lot. I draw a lot while I'm out there. I always bring them. I mean, not necessarily while we're working during the day, but just to have some kind of release and creative mind, keep my mind actively creative. I do a lot of sketching.
Now, there's not a lot of time for sketching, but with an average of 14 hours a day on the line, the engines Jessica works on are mainly there to get water to the line for initial attacks. This is when there are new starts and you're the first ones out to the fire. Here's an example.
I think it was my second year on fires, so I was 19 years old probably, and I was with my dad and my older brother, and we were in Hardin, Montana. And the fires over there are, I mean, it's really eastern Montana. And so the fires burn quick and hot, and then they're out because it's cattle lands and grass fields and things like that. And we had been on IA all day, just on call. We hadn't had any new starts or anything, so we had just been doing normal work all day. And dinner time rolls around, and we get called out. So we've done a full day of work, and we get called out on this lightning strike, this lightning start. And it takes 2 hours for them to figure out where this is and to get us out there and all these roundabout, windy back country roads to get to this fire. And by that time, it's dark. And fire is so much scarier and more intense looking in the dark. It is like, it's just this monster, this red breathing fire, scary, scary thing. And we pull up to this, and my brother has been doing this for probably 4 or 5 years at this time, and my dad's been doing it forever. And it's only my second year, and we pull up to this fire, and I was scared. I was really scared, and I tried not to let it show because you never want to show fear. And my brother, I remember, he didn't show a lot of emotion, and my brother grabbed my hand, and he said, "It's going to be okay," because I thought I was hiding it better, but apparently he could tell that I was scared. It could have been that he felt that uncertainty too, because it's not a familiar thing to be fighting fire at night in the dark. It's a scary thing just in itself. And with this being an initial attack, a brand new start, it was just blowing up. And it was in timber. And we just started trying to build a fire line around this. And at points in the night, we worked all through the night. And at points in the night, my boots would get so hot that I could feel my feet felt like they were burning, and because I would be digging and all this hot stuff, and my friend Jesse, who fights fires on a different engine with us, he would spray my boots off, because he would have the hose, he would spray my boots off, and I would keep digging, and I mean, by that time, it just boils right off of your boots, because your boots are too hot.
Like
mm-hmm. So my feet just hurt. Leather. They're the thick sole, heavy-duty work boots.
How did you feel when you're
Well, I felt comforted that he was there and he was going to keep me safe, and I knew that, but I also was a little unnerved that he had been concerned enough to tell me, "Oh, it's going to be okay." You know, he was obviously on edge too. So that was scary. But yeah, we fought fire all night on this fire, and in the morning, I'll never forget this. In the morning, they got us up. They told us to bed down around 4 o'clock, I think, where there were no rattlesnakes. And I said, oh, the cab looks great. I'm going to sleep right here. So I fell asleep with my hard hat and my gloves still on, just sitting upright in the pickup. And they woke us up again in just a few hours and had us go back to work. We just slept right out there on the fire line. And we're out there working the next morning. This is the most tired any of us have ever been. My dad, my brother, and I, just mentally exhausted. Don't know how our bodies are still functioning because we've just worked the hardest day of our lives. And this guy comes, and we're doing this for a few hours, and we're like, I can't believe that that they have us out here still doing this when our work to sleep ratio has been completely blown out of the water. They have just disregarded that. And I'm out there working, and this guy comes tearing up on his four-wheeler. It's the landowner. And we have just been working all night, working our asses off to save this guy's land, and did a really, really amazing job. And he pulls up and he goes, a woman firefighter? When I used to fight fire back in the day, this is bull. We don't let women fight. And I just stopped. I couldn't even say anything. I was so blown away by this guy's arrogance. I just stood there, and nobody else heard. I just wanted to take this guy out. I couldn't believe it. I know. I couldn't believe it. I'll never forget that feeling of just complete.
How'd you deal with that?
I didn't.
Had your mind churning for hours.
Oh yeah.
Days, weeks.
Oh yeah. I was fuming, and I didn't have the. I don't know. I couldn't even speak. We were so tired. I didn't say anything back to him. I just stared at him in disbelief. I couldn't believe it. And my dad came up afterwards, and I was just livid, just pissed. And he's like, "What is wrong?" And I told him what happened, and he couldn't believe it. And he felt horrible. And I was just like, no, this is not right. And I mean, there was nothing we could do about it, but
yeah, makes you real tempted to let it burn,
though, doesn't it? Oh yeah, I couldn't believe it. Yeah, you're welcome, buddy.
That would have been an okay response too. Did you have responses
lined up? Oh yeah. No, I would probably spray him with the hose. If I was just standing there with the hose, I should have just sprayed him right in the face, I think, and been like, "You jerk." Or
that would have been a real good response.
I know. I really wish I would have.
Have you had to use anything like that since? Has anybody else said anything so or close to as rude?
Well, it's always a struggle being respected. I have to work twice as hard as any guy that I work with to get any respect as a woman out there.
Jessica has learned a lot in her 4 years of firefighting, including how to not take a lot of crap.
We were in California this summer, and we were on a fire. We had just gotten there that night, so I mean, we weren't dirty yet or anything, because we had just gotten into camp, driven all day to get to camp, and we were supposed to eat dinner and bed down, they told us. So we're in line. We have our Nomex on and everything, and we're in line to get dinner. And one of the camp crew people, the people that run the camp that we stay in, came up to me and said, are you here with a crew or an engine? And I was like, I'm on an engine. What engine are you on? Just grilling me with questions. And I was like, I'm on Troy Fire Service. We're on a contract engine. And he goes, you just look out of place. I said, excuse me? He goes, you just look out of place. You don't look the part. Are you sure you're... Like, he thought I was just there for a free meal or something. And I was like, yes, I'm here on the fire. What have you been doing all day? I was so pissed. Because he's not a firefighter. He's not out there fighting fire either. He just thought that I looked out of place. And I said, what have you been doing all day?
How did he answer?
He just stood there. And then he okay, and then walked away.
Good.
I was, and then I, of course, went, my dad was the one that got the wrath of it. I went and sat down with him and told him what happened, and I was just pissed.
The work does deserve respect and generally gets it from everyone. I saw Jessica on break from firefighting a couple summers ago when she went out to celebrate her 21st birthday. She was gorgeous, as I generally know her to be, all curls and glow in her skirt and makeup, trailed by an entourage of guys, her guy friends, fellow firefighters. What I saw was a bunch of young, wiry, strong men trailing a girly girl into the bar.
See, I don't feel girly.
No,
I feel. I feel very, especially when I'm out on fires. I guess I feel very frumpy and blah.
Yeah.
Like my first days back off of fires, I just want to be a girl again. I just want to feel like a girl again. And I get all dolled up, and we usually will go out. Because my brothers, definitely, because I fight fires with my two older brothers usually, and they will definitely, they want to celebrate being home. And so I turn back into a girl, and I let my hair down, and
yeah.
It's fun.
Put on the makeup.
Mm-hmm. Because when we're, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because it's usually warm, and in the summer, if I'm not on fires, I am in a skirt.
Jessica is, like most of us, more than just one-dimensional. She's a girly girl and a tough girl. A woman working in a man's world, sometimes, and taking lessons from the experiences into the rest of her life.
Yeah, I think I've had a lot more confidence. Just because it makes me feel like I'm doing something good. I'm helping. I'm doing something good with my life. I'm better person, maybe.
You think you're going to keep firefighting?
Yeah, I think I will keep firefighting as long as I am physically able. I really like it. I'd like to have a job or career in the off season that would allow me to fight fire in the summer. Because it's a really rewarding thing. And it all just comes with time. I mean, I've only been doing it for 4 years. Lots of people have been doing this a lot longer. And you learn something new every year. You learn so much more, and you see how things work more, and it just comes with time and with experience. You can take all the classes in the world that you want. Like, lots of people just take all these classes and think that they're just ready, and they know everything about fire, and that's definitely not the case. My dad's been doing this for 20-plus years, and I mean, he's completely humble about it. He would never make anybody think that he knew more than them, and he knows a lot about fire. And I see that from the things that he tells me, and then I see it applied out there. And he's always trying to learn new things, always just completely open to learning more stuff about fire.
Do you think part of that is just plain old respect for the fire?
Yeah, probably. It's a big, scary thing, fire, but you have to respect it. People get hurt when they underestimate Mother Nature.
Jessica Hawkinson is a firefighter originally out of Troy, Idaho, where she grew up and where her family still lives. She's now living in Boise, and she's out on the lines each summer, wherever the fires are raging. You're listening to Yin Radio, and our show today is called Elements. Now, we've covered the elements except Earth, so this fourth installment does cover that. It comes from author Buddy Levy, who lives in Idaho and teaches at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. He did this reading of his essay, Defending Dry Fly Ranch, in Moscow, Idaho, last year. And while the readings focused on stories of the outdoors and the environment, you could say that this essay is as much about the earth element as it is about a fifth element, spirit. Here's Buddy Levy.
My book that's coming out is called Conquistador, Hernan Cortez, Montezuma, and the Last Stand of the Aztecs. And I thought of reading a passage on human ritual sacrifice tonight, which, according to the conquering Spaniards, seemed like extreme behavior. But, of course, to the Aztecs, it was just wholesome religious family fun. But I've decided instead, because we're working in an environmental landscape-based theme, to read a piece from an essay that I first wrote as a poem, following a time period I spent living on a ranch in south central Idaho, and it's a work in progress, a collection of essays that deals with landscape and my time there. And I wanted to read an essay that I've sort of resurrected and am looking at a little bit again, and it's called Defending Dry Fly Ranch. One spring morning when I was about 13, my father walked me across our ranch, out through barbed wire fences and irrigation ditches to the heron rookery at Silver Creek. We hid beneath towering cottonwoods, watching the parent birds sail from their nests, their arched necks dipping with flight, seeking food for their young. When they returned, craws tight with meal, we could hear the keen chirps of the chicks go quiet as the parents fed them. From my earth and sagebrush blind at the base of the tall cottonwoods, they looked tiny and distant, just thatched saucer shapes against the skyline. I told my father how high they appeared to me, and he paused, nodding. Then he said, "When she thinks they're ready, the mother coaxes them out of the nest with her beak." I pictured an innocent bird, frail and unsteady, plummeting to the ground beside me. "What if they can't fly?" I asked. He grinned as if he'd expected such a question. "They either learn in a hurry or they don't," he said, and he turned, hoofing back toward the log cabin. At the time, I wasn't prepared to contemplate the rites of passage that parents impose upon their young, but in my later teens, at the onset of my father's retirement, I was, for a short time, handed the reins to the ranch. I know now that the responsibility he offered was out of convenience for himself, but partly it was to see whether I would learn to fly or not. Then, almost as if by design, my first tough ranch duties unfolded before me. Duties carried out by my hands, hands directed by the will of a father, the will of an owner. We had a hen house, a converted outbuilding set up on a knoll above the old farmhouse, far enough to wake you in the morning on your way to get the eggs, scuffing along the dirt road, slapping skeeters. One morning, I pushed the pine door open, and as light spilled across the floor, I sensed the sharpness of skunk and saw the hens huddled in a corner. A little skunk appeared, an adolescent with whiskers like a kitten's, an egg on his face. "Get rid of it," my father said on the phone. "He'll eat every last egg." We didn't really need the eggs, of course. My father was a retired physician, now playing at rancher, and raising farm-fresh eggs was part of the game. It's true that we grew barley, which we sold to Coors, sometimes even for a small profit. And moving miles of pipe through the dank, mosquito-infested grain was one of my jobs, but I always understood that our lives and livelihoods did not depend on the ranch. Reluctantly, I knelt on the feather-strewn wood slats and investigated. I discovered a family of skunks under the floorboards, five or six of them at least. If I even considered the idea of trying to relocate them, I quickly realized that was impractical. I was alone out there. I walked to the shed and saw the rusted iron muskrat traps hanging from 16 penny nails. I took one down, compressed the side springs, opened the jaws of the leg hold trap, and imagined the snap, then decided against it. What does one do with a trapped skunk spraying everywhere? Instead, I grabbed the pellet rifle and headed back to the hen house, pumping as I walked. The little stinker was near the door, ducking underneath when the first pellet struck him. He fell onto his hind legs and rolled over. He clawed at dirt, and I reloaded and pumped quickly, wanting to get it over with. Cradling a skunk and a spade gives you time to see the beauty in the animal, white stripe painted down the back straight as a highway line. I walked to the clearing with my head low, wind brushing the skunk's hair. Spooning it onto the dirt, I couldn't ignore the tiny black pads of its feet, the oily sheen of the coat in the morning light. The digging was easy, and the hole kept growing and enlarging, becoming darker and deeper until I felt like I could have climbed in there myself. One by one, five small skunks surfaced from beneath the hen house. None ever sprayed me, though most squirted, their backs arched against the sting of the pellet. The hole I dug became a grave I marked with a railroad stake and a big flat piece of obsidian as black as a skunk's coat. It had to do with ownership, or the idea of ownership, anyway. This was his ranch, and these were his hens, and pests like skunks broke down the order he believed he had imposed on the place. Never mind the skunks' prior claim to the land. They weren't supposed to be there in the hen house, and I was charged with ridding the ranch of them. The skunks were to my father the animal equivalent of a weed, something growing where you don't want it. Such justifications didn't make burying them any easier, didn't ease the hurt of each shovelful of dirt tamped into the mound. For a long time, whenever I passed the skunk burial ground, I'd nose the wind and try to catch a whiff of them. I can still smell them now, sweet and acrid at once. Long afterwards, I remember my father stopping what he was doing and looking up sharply, arrested by a breeze that carried skunk scent. "Thought you got those skunks," he said. My father's prize wasn't the log cabin we'd built on the place, with its panoramic view of the Queen's Crown to the east, Timmerman Hill to the west. It wasn't the slough above the headgate, low, slow-moving water where rainbows boiled in the evenings. It wasn't even the duck blinds we'd made along Loving Creek, tule and tumbleweed hideouts we worked on when the first frost came. No, my father's favorite pet was his trout pond. He had developed it from a spring fed by an artesian well. Watercress mulched the ground in bunches at its headwaters. That's how he got the idea. We were eating watercress salad one night, the crunchy greens topped with blood-red Idaho beets, and he said, "I can build a pond below the spring." So he did. Built it with backhoe and dragline and dozer. Had me rototill the berm, turning up the loamy soil until twilight intensified instinct. Mallards calling in spirals, owls blinking in the willows, cranes and herons winging silhouettes against the sky. I'd stop tilling, plop down in the cool soil, and gaze in disbelief at where I was. I'd run the ripe ground through my fingers and listen to the talk of wild things. So the berm was planted with ground cover that went wild too, birdfoot trefoil and sizer milk vetch and showy loco weed. The stuff climbed the banks like vine, and soon my father had dammed it and brought in a truckload of lunker trout and had them dumped in. We built an automatic feeder that sprayed food pellets in a fishy swath twice daily, causing a feeding frenzy that evoked Amazonian piranhas. These were actually Snake River hatchery trout, and planting them was sanctioned by the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. My father liked to chum the big bruisers along the banks, tossing handfuls of the pellets like chicken feed and grinning as the hefty trout thrashed the surface, their silver sides flashing as they tore for the spoils. But it turned out he was also unintentionally chumming for herons. "Come look at this," my father said one morning as he walked me to the pond. Four large trout, each two boots or better in length, lay dead on the banks, flies swirling around their eyes and vents. Each fish had an identical telltale harpoon mark through its side. Blood had dried to scales where the great blue heron's spear-like bill had stabbed the skin of the fish. The heron hadn't eaten them. Too big to swallow whole, my father grumbled as he slung the trout into the willows for coyotes, trout meant to be caught by our visiting ranch guests. Stealthy and patient, herons possess a perfect design. Keen eyesight, a long spear-thrower neck, and a dagger bill that skewers fish in a swift and fatal blur stroke. Sometimes I'd see what looked like a tree stump and branches shifting slightly in the stream, a heron fishing. Gray skeletons of birds, they stalk slowly, barely disturbing the water as they lift and place one stilt-like leg after another. Often they stand in place on one leg until a fish comes near. Then they dart, head and neck and bill in symphony, breaking the window of water like a diving kingfisher, faster than human eyes can see. But this had to do with ownership. These were my father's fish, and the sanctity of his pond was being violated by a predator. The Browning's in the gun case, he said as he steered away, dust curling behind the Suburban. Never mind the potential fine, this was private property and we were protecting our crop. I grabbed shells and loaded as I walked, knowing I'd never get a jump shot. Herons are smart and as wary as any bird. The heron had been at the pond since daybreak. Before I got within 100 yards, the bird lifted, low at first, then clipping over the willows along the creek, sailing the meanders upstream to the big pond above the headgate. I crept under some brush and hid and watched the bird curve and arc and boomerang back, looking like some immense pterodactyl in the distance, its head and neck folded back, feet trailing behind. Unbelievably, the heron came right toward me from the slough, just above the line of willows, came the way ducks do during season, and I held the Browning tight, not really thinking what I'd do until it happened. It was a single shot, one barrel of the 12-gauge Browning reporting, and the instantaneous stoppage of wings, the awkward midair crumpling, and the dull thud of the great bird's brunt beyond the willow belt. Then all was silent on the stream except my breathing and the pulse in my temples. Wading the stream, I could smell the spent gunpowder, then caught the dry scent of sage. The great blue heron lay stone dead. The yellow footlong bill had snapped on impact and now jutted at a fractured, unnatural angle. Bigger than I'd imagined, the bird sprawled a shotgun length along the ground, and I marveled at the blue-gray gloss of its feathers. My eyes moved up the neck, along the cinnamon-colored tendrils, to the head with its forked topknot. Set in the wide-open yellow eye was a dark and piercing pupil, wild and intelligent, and, only moments before, alive. I knelt in the dirt next to the bird and felt a rush of wind, and looked away to see clouds forming in the east like clenched fists over the lava flows. I remained quiet, letting my body freeze to the spot, not moving for the longest time, staunch and silent as the heron would be, fishing the pond as if he owned it, searching for food to bring back to its young. Eventually, I stood and lifted the heron by the neck and carried it back to the cabin, staying near the thick willows along the stream and scanning for any unwelcome visitors. I slid the big bird in a black plastic garbage bag and called my father. Skin it like a pheasant, he said. Use a lot of borax and tack it out in the shed. I'll use the feathers for tying steelhead flies. That afternoon, I did as he said, splaying the gray pelt out to cure on the table beneath the muskrat traps. I tossed the fishy entrails into the field for coyotes, the magnificent bird now carrion. Then I slathered on some DEET, sprayed my greasy Stetson with muskall, pulled on my hip boots, and headed out to move the pipe. As I walked along the irrigation canal to the first hand line, I glimpsed something in my periphery and looked up to see the unmistakable slow and rhythmical wing beats of a great blue heron landing on the banks of our trout pond. The bird settled in to begin its evening fishing, and I turned away, turned back to my duty of watering barley we didn't need, barley destined to become someone else's beer. Thank you.
Buddy Levy, reading his essay, Defending Dry Fly Ranch, at a public reading in Moscow, Idaho last year. Now, for this last installment of our Element show, we return to water with a story from Jessica Partno of the Common Language Project.
Dilo Town is a short stretch of thatched huts lining a dirt road in southern Ethiopia. About 32,000 people live in this community. It's 44 miles from the nearest paved road, 9 from the closest man-made well, and 2 days' drive from the capital city, Addis Ababa. We're close to the Kenyan border here, and not much else. By 6 a.m., Fadi Jilo is hard at work.
I wake up early in the morning and I light a fire to make some tea for breakfast.
Fadi is 30 years old and has 3 young children.
Then I clean my house, I have goats, and I take them to pasture. After I take the goats, I go to fetch water.
This is the height of Ethiopia's dry season. Water and pasture for livestock are scarce. Fadi is anxiously awaiting the rains, expected by the beginning of March. For now, with no water falling from the sky, Fadi must make the long walk to haul it from a spring. As I follow her toward the edge of Dilo Town in the pale morning sunlight, we're joined by several other women in colorful sari-like dresses.
Safia.
Each woman is carrying a jerry can, a 5.5-gallon plastic jug. The cans are a crucial commodity. A new one can cost half of a family's annual cash income. As we reach the end of the short dirt path leading out of town, we come to the rim of a deep crater. At the bottom, there's a former salt lake, brown mud crusted over with glistening white salt.
More than 100 women fetch water here every day. Even other women from the surrounding areas come to collect water here.
The spring is a natural pool tucked into the side of the crater. The water is brackish and shared with hundreds of sheep, goats, and cattle. Their waste contaminates the water supply, causing everything from amoebic dysentery and intestinal parasites to scabies and conjunctivitis. Many people here, especially young children and the elderly, suffer constantly from these ailments.
We get very sick from the water here. People have stomachache, diarrhea with blood, even death. About 20 people die here every year.
Boiling would help prevent waterborne illness, but no one here can afford the fuel. Each woman fills her jerry can at the edge of the pool, screwing the lid on over a tiny square of plastic cut from a plastic bag. The extra plastic bolsters the worn threads on the lip of the jar and keeps every drop of water inside. A full jerry can weighs 44 pounds. Fadi struggles to hoist her load up the steep bank of the shallow pool, a bank made steeper every day by dropping water levels. She makes a cushion out of a bright green shawl, which she ties onto the small of her back. The bottom of the jerry can rests on this padding, and she binds the full can to herself with rope made from animal sinews. Imagine strapping 10 2-liter bottles of soda to your back and walking straight uphill in flimsy plastic sandals.
We're walking up a very steep, rocky slope. All of them except for the 11-year-old and the 13-year-old have 20 liters of water on their back. For me, carrying 1.5 liters is exhausting.
Fadi and the other women make this trek 3 times a day. Their walk is only 1.5-hour round trip, shorter than in some areas, but it's long enough for the women to get hurt.
People break their bones, they dislocate their joints. And the problem is worse when we go to fetch water when it is dark. One woman fell down while she was pregnant and she lost the baby.
There is hope for water in Dilo Town. The government says it plans to start work on bringing piped water to Dilo next year. But Fadi doubts that will happen.
We have applied so many times for help, for them to provide us with a water system, but nobody responds to us. They have promised us so many times, but they haven't done anything.
Fadi's life would change dramatically with regular access to safe water. Her daughters would be able to go to school every day, something they can't do now since school shuts down when there's no water. And Fadi would be able to spend more time tending livestock and earning money for her family. Till then, she waits for the three-month-long rainy season, when her water walks will stop for a while. Or so she hopes. A recent UN report says global warming is intensifying droughts in Ethiopia. And Fadi says that lately the rains in Dilo have only been lasting half as long as they used to. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jessica Partnow.
You can see, read, and hear more of Jessica Partnow's work for the CLP project at clpmag.org. Let's wrap it up. This Yin Radio show is ending with a song that goes back to the water element, along with some wind mixed in. It's called Storm, and it's by Hungry Lucy. You can listen to past shows or podcast this show, or you can sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio@vpfound.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. Thanks so much for joining me. Until next week.